If you'll turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we are moving through this book. We have finished chapter 9 and last week, and we come to chapter 10 today. And our attention will be on the first 11 verses of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And I was thinking as those verses were being read, and maybe as you heard them read, and maybe as you have even looked at them, and considering everything that we've been talking about in 1 Corinthians up till now, especially 8 through 10, you're probably wondering, is Paul regressing here? Has he changed the subject here? It seems like he's talking about something completely different than what he's been talking about. Idols and food offered to idols and things like that. How did we get here to this example that he lays out for us in 1 Corinthians 10, 1 through 11? Is he just regressing or digressing in his thinking, and is something going on there? Is this a new topic? But no, this is not a new topic. This flows right with 1 Corinthians 8 and 9. We move into chapter 10, and these verses very much fit the context of what he's referring to in these verses. I told you in chapter 8 that the Apostle Paul is dealing with the wrong attitudes that the Corinthians have. They know theology really well, but they misuse it. They beat people over the heads with it. They're not loving with it. They have the right theology regarding food that's been sacrificed to idols, that meat is nothing. There's no such thing as an idol. And it's nothing to it, but there are your weaker brothers, and you are making them, you're offending them with your knowledge. Knowledge is a good thing. We all need knowledge, but it must be used in a way to build up others and not tear them down. So the first problem we saw in chapter 8 was the self-centered focus that many of the Corinthians had. They were using this only to their own benefit, not for the benefit of others. In chapter 9, the Apostle Paul lays out his own example of how he has given up his liberties regarding issues, these gray area issues, and how he has laid aside his rights as an apostle, even not to take a salary for his preaching. I'm an apostle. I have the right to expect this from you, but because I want the gospel to be furthered, to be spread, he said, I chose to lay that expectation aside. I gave up my rights. I'm an example, trying to be an example to you of what it means to be others focused and not self focused. I am a slave to Christ, therefore I'm a slave to others, he says through more than half the book of chapter 9, more than half of chapter 10, 9. As we come now to chapter 10, chapter 10 actually starts back up in 9:24. The verses in 24 and following in 9 and all the way into 10, I would say, are one section. You don't have the chapter divisions in the original. But what he's talking about in verses 9, 24 through 27, about running the race, that connects very well to what we're going to be looking at today in chapter 10. Because chapter 10, he's not giving an example of his personal example. He's going to start out by giving an example of the nation Israel. And what he's going to do is give some instruction in this chapter. Very important instruction regarding this whole idol meat sacrifice to idol, going to the pagan temple, things like that. Issues. He's going to address those in this section. The first half of the chapter, he's going to say this. This is what he's going to say in verses 1 through 22. Stop going to the temple. Just stop. If you're a believer, you have no business going to the pagan temple for any reason whatsoever. And then he's going to say in the last half of chapter 10, he's going to instruct them that don't worry about meat that you buy at the butcher shop. Don't worry about if it previously was on an altar to Zeus. Don't worry about that. Just buy it. So he's going to give two things there. Two issues are going to be addressed in chapter 10. He's going to give instruction on these issues. On that first issue, the rebellious Corinthians, many of them had gone to the temple, the pagan temple, on a regular basis prior to coming to Christ. And they couldn't understand why, now that I'm a Christian, why would it matter? I'm not going to let that influence me. I'm not going to let that have an effect on me. I'm just going to go to that temple. And I mean, I got friends there. I got family there. That's the social life of our community there. And I want to go hang out there. I have freedom to do that. I have freedom to eat meat that's been sacrificed to an idol because I don't believe in that idol. Why can't I just go there? Besides that, I've been baptized and I take communion. I mean, surely those things give me some kind of Teflon protection, don't they? They sort of keep me from being corrupted by any of these outside influences like that. The second issue of chapter 10, just buy the meat in the marketplace and don't worry about it. Don't worry about if it's been sacrificed to an idol. And many were concerned that they would be eating one of those Zeus steaks. You know what I'm saying? They were concerned about that. And others were not. And what Paul is going to do is saying, like I said earlier, he's going to say, don't worry about it, just buy it. But these insensitive Corinthians, some of them had tried to mix the issue. And what they were saying is, if you're telling people to eat it in the privacy of their home, why wouldn't you tell them to eat it in the public, in the temple restaurant? You follow me? The difference between doing something to express your freedom in Christ, why wouldn't you tell them just to eat it in the temple like we're doing? They were trying to mix the two issues. If it's right to do in home, it's right to do in public. And Paul's going to say, no, you don't go and flaunt it. You might offend somebody, but there's nothing wrong with eating it at your house because there's no such thing as an idol. The meat is being sacrificed to a nothing. Now granted, he is going to say there are demons behind these idols, but in terms of how they would be looking at them just from some molten image, he would say, there's nothing to it, don't worry about it. That kind of gives you an overview of where this chapter is going and what we're going to be looking at, the two issues that are there. So Paul is going to give that instruction, separating out those two issues. In verses 1 through 22, we're going to start looking at that today, where he tells them, stop going to the temple altogether. You licentious Corinthians who want to hang out there, quit hanging out there. And 23 through the end of the chapter will be in the weeks to come. I told you this, that verses 1 through 22 rely heavily on verses 24 through 27 of chapter 9. Look at those. I spent 2 weeks going through 24 through 27. They're sort of the lead-in to chapter 10, and they rely heavily. The beginning of chapter 10 relies heavily on what Paul says in those verses. He's talking in those verses of 24 through 27 about sanctification. Understand something. Your salvation has been accomplished by Christ alone. You can do nothing to improve on that. You can do nothing to obtain that. You can do nothing to maintain that. That is God's work in your life if you're a Christian. That is God, all God, all God. But sanctification has two contributors. One is God and the other is you. And that's what's important to keep that distinction clear. And the only reason you can even be involved in the process of sanctification is because it is God who is at work in you. But sanctification is the message of 1 Corinthians 9, 24 through 27. And he says this, do you not know that those who run in a race, he calls the Christian life a race, run to receive a prize. He says, you run in such a way that you may win. Not that you're running against other people, but you run in such a way that you may win. You run with excellence. And then he says, you need to be busy running. That's what sanctification is. Christ has already won this race for us, but in sanctification, we are to depend on him for this spirit produced self-restraint that's required in sanctification. He uses the word self-control. You notice that in verse 25, maybe? 20, somebody help me. 25. Yeah, I see it. 25. We need self-control. A spirit-induced self-control is needed in this sanctification, in this running this race. And so this was what we talked about in weeks past. In verse 26, I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air. I don't shadow box. I make my punches count in this race I'm running in. I make my punches count in terms of beating my flesh up, because my flesh is my problem. He says that in verse 27, I discipline my body and make it my slave. It's the flesh that wars against the soul, isn't it? That's what this race is about. It's a race against sin. It's a race against my flesh. And Paul is saying, I don't want to be disqualified. And there are things that could hinder you in this race. And Paul is saying, I don't want to be disqualified. And so Paul sort of sets up that passage there to go into chapter 10, because there were many in the Corinthian church who were in danger of being disqualified in running the race of sanctification. And so that's how this fits in the context there. They were disqualified because they had encumbrances. They were disqualified because they had entangling sins. They had things that were slowing them down, like a racehorse trying to pull a plow. You just can't run, be hindered. And so that's what he's doing. He's trying to address those things to the Corinthians in chapter 10. I'll look at a couple of those hindrances today, and then we'll finish this up in weeks to come. But he lists some hindrances here that I think are very practical. They have very much to do with the Corinthian problem, and we'll talk about those as we look at them. But the first one, they had a wrong view of the ordinances of baptism and communion. Now you're going to say, how in the world did you see that in these verses? And let me just show you that as we go through this. But let me just start out by saying it is clear as you read through these and think through what he is saying in these verses that the Corinthians were viewing their baptism and their communion as some kind of magical ritual that protected them. Folks, this is not uncommon. People who are into a lot of ritualism think that's protecting them in their Christian life from from immorality and other things like that. If I just do the right rituals, I'm okay, and I'll be okay. And he is saying to them, that's not Teflon. That's not protecting you. They think it is. Communion and baptism, however, cannot kill the influences of sin. And that's what Paul's point is. They cannot keep you from being defiled. If you go to that temple and participate in those drunken parties, they can't protect you. If you participate in those orgies and things that go on in that temple, they can't protect you. Those rituals can't protect you from not engaging in those things. They're not, no matter, they don't protect you no matter what's going on around you. It doesn't work like that. And you think of it from a historical perspective, there are many people who are depending on baptism and communion and confirmation and lighting candles and praying prayers. And just whatever ritual thing you can think of, they're counting on rituals. That's very common. And that somehow those things will protect me. And it doesn't matter all the other sinful things around me. I don't have to worry about self-control. I don't have to worry about self-restraint. I'm protected by these things, from the world and those things in the world, by these rituals that I participate in and am faithful to participate in. I can be around all kinds of sinful activity and I'll be okay. lying, greed, drunkenness, the movies I watch, the places I go to on my computer, it doesn't matter. I have the rituals in place. I've jumped through those hoops and I've done those things. And therefore, I'm okay with God because I've done the right things. And that is a very wrong view of baptism. It's a very wrong view of communion, and specifically the two issues we're talking about here in the opening verses of chapter 10. And Paul corrects that. And here's the question you might ask. You say, why would any Christian want to go to a pagan temple? I mean, none of you are sitting here today thinking, I wish I could go to a Hindu temple today. None of you are thinking, I wish I could go to a Buddhist temple today. All that seems sort of creepy to us. Or to a mosque, even. It's just foreign to us how they could even want to go to the temple of Diana or to the temple of Zeus or to some other Greek god. Why would you want to go there? And I've alluded to this many times as we've been in this section and saying this to you, but in Western society, we have done a good job of separating religion, the sacred and the secular. We've done a good job of that. That is not how it's been in most of human history. In Greek society, religion was part of life. What you did in that temple affected everyday life. Every birthday party that your family had was at the temple. Every social event that you had was at the temple. Every event that you participated in with your friends or family or anything political, whatever, was at the temple. It wasn't like you and I who we go to church and we check that off and it has no connection to anything else we do the rest of the week. But for them, everything they would do there connected to everything in life. And so to have grown up going there and to all of a sudden stop going there was not an easy thing. Everything in life touched the temple. It is all intertwined. Worship God, worship the gods, sacrifice to the gods, weddings, funerals, your health even. Thanking the gods for your good health and sacrificing to them for your good health. Business successes. It was the biggest party in town, as I've alluded to this many times as we've come up to this passage, but this is the problem. This is the problem. And you have people in the Corinthian church who have become believers. They want to go back there. They're pulled back there. And their reasoning is, I got the rituals in place. I'm protected. At least that's the passage we're dealing with here. That's what they're saying here. So it's no small thing to abandon going to the temple. Your community would think you were nuts if you stopped going there. They would think that you had just lost your mind. That'd be conspicuous. That'd be, what? Why are you doing that? Why did you stop going? Your family would not understand. Listen, this was a huge, huge lordship issue. To turn away from the temple. A huge issue of, I'm going to follow Christ and the world may hate me, but I'm going to follow Christ. I'm going to lay things that are not helpful in the race, I'm going to lay them aside. That would be very difficult for them to do because it was so connected to everything in their lives. To love family, to love God more than you love your family would be very real to them because so much of family life was around that pagan temple and the activities of family life were around that pagan temple. We're not like that. We're secular. When we come here, it's not always connected to the rest of our lives. But that's unusual, really, in human history because throughout history, it's always been right there together. And so, why can't we just keep mingling and mixing in like we always have? Paul's going to tell them, hey, get out of the place. That's what he's going to say in the first 22 verses. You've got to leave that place. It's not helping you in running this race. You're in danger of being disqualified. That's what he's going to tell them. You don't think you are. You think you've got a Teflon shielding because you've been baptized and you've got communion going on. You think that way. And so that's how this gets set up by 9:24 through 27. Disqualification is possible, Paul is going to say. That's how he ended chapter 9, verse 27. I don't want to be disqualified. Hey, listen, disqualification is possible for you. Loss of reward, loss of hearing, well done, good and faithful servant, loss of your influence, loss of your effectiveness, loss of your joy, loss of all of those things that are benefits of knowing God. What's even more dangerous is the fact of God's judgment. You may be giving evidence to the fact you're not even a Christian. And so look at verse 1 of chapter 10. For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren. The word is ignorant, actually. I don't want you to be ignorant about this, brethren. That our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. He's saying you need to be running the race of sanctification. That's the word for in verse 1. You see the word for connects us back to the very thing we just talked about in chapter 9. I don't want you to be ignorant. You think you're so clever, but you're ignorant. Acting as if baptism and communion were enough to protect you from sin or when you sin. And then he says, our fathers, all believers, by the way, are rooted in the Old Testament. We are of the faith of Abraham. All Christians are rooted in Abraham's faith, even though we're Gentiles. So all Christians are rooted, have roots in the Old Testament. And here he is referring to the Exodus because he says that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea. So we're talking here about the generation that came out of Egypt and went into the wilderness. He takes them back to the Old Testament, authenticating the fact that it's inspired by God, by the way. But the point is, he takes them back to there for his example. I just gave you an example out of my own life of how I run this race. And now let me tell you about a negative example. That's what he's going to give them here, a negative example. To help you see that you too might be disqualified as they were. Verse 2 says, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. That's the baptism I'm going to talk about in just a minute. That was the symbol. That for us, it's the water. We're baptized into Christ. They were baptized into Moses. I'll talk about that in just a moment. In the cloud and in the sea. Switches to communion, verse 3. And ate the same spiritual food. Verse 4. And all drank the same spiritual drink. For they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them. And the rock was Christ. And so, stay with me on this, but there's he's talking about. They were baptized. They took communion. But nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased. You would have think they would have been shielded. You would think they would have been protected. But God was not pleased with them, and they were laid low in the wilderness. So we got some typological connections here. I get it, but you're wrong for thinking baptism will protect you, and that's how he's going to direct our thoughts here. The passing through the Red Sea, I think what you're looking at in verse 1, the cloud and the sea, the Red Sea was what God separated, and they walked through, and you can imagine these towers of water on both sides as the people are walking through, the cloud behind them, most likely, under the cloud, same idea, but mostly the cloud directing them as they were doing this. God had taken them out of Egypt and made them a separate people from the Egyptians, and he takes them into the wilderness and has this cloud in the Red Sea, and Paul says they were baptized into Moses. Basically, they were identified with Moses. That's what meaning of baptism. They are identified with Moses by this baptism, this experience. This experience of the cloud, this experience of the Red Sea. means they were identified with Moses. We're identified with Christ in baptism. Our symbol of our baptism is the water, the immersion. We're immersed into Christ and risen to new life. We become one in Christ in that picture. That's a spiritual, that's a physical event that points back to a spiritual reality that we were spiritually baptized, placed into Jesus Christ, made one with Christ, set free from the power of sin and bondage of sin. That's what our baptism represents. It's just a picture of what Christ has done in our lives, and the symbol of that is the water. For them, the symbol was the passing through the Red Sea and the cloud, and they were baptized into Moses. They identified with Moses. He was the one that led them. Our leader is Christ. They were led by Moses into this. So we're speaking figuratively here. I understand that. And then you see communion. You see communion in verses 3 and 4. Verses 3 and 4. And ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from the spiritual rock which followed them. The rock was Christ. We're told two places that We're told in one place, actually, that God, in many other places, but particularly that God provided manna from heaven when they were in the wilderness. He provided food. The word manna means, what is it? And that's what they would say when they saw it. What is it? But it was food. God provided that for them. For 40 years, he provided for them. And then it says they all drank the same spiritual drink. We have two passages, Exodus 17 and Numbers 20, where God used the rock to provide water to the people in the wilderness. And this is interesting, and the rock was Christ. You see that at the end of verse 4. You should see what commentaries do with that statement. Oh my goodness, it's all over the map. The rock was Christ. How is that? How are you talking about the wilderness and you're saying this rock was Christ? Let me show you something. Go to Exodus 23 for a moment. Hold your hand there in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and go to Exodus 23. He says in verse 20 of Exodus 23, God is speaking to Moses and says to him in verse 20, "Behold, I am going to send you an angel." The word angel is interpreted messenger, okay? I'm going to send you a messenger, an angel, before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Verse 21, be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. Now, wait a second. Angels don't pardon transgressions. And since my name is in him, and that's not said of any angel. I have here a messenger whose God's name is in, and I have a messenger here, or an angel, who has the power to pardon sin. I am not talking about just any old angel like Michael or Gabriel here. I am talking about what theologians describe as the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ. He will be the one who guides you. He's going to guard you. He's going to bring you into the place I've prepared, verse 20 says. He's pictured as a pillar of fire at times, all throughout their wilderness wandering. He bears God's name. All of those things, this is God himself. That's the point. We're talking about God himself. It's God the Son who takes on the incarnational role. And so we're talking here about the second person of the Trinity. And so the question is, how does Paul know that that rock from which they got the water was Christ? That's what I'm answering. Because this messenger, this angel, forgives sin, and this angel has God's name. This angel is God. And because the second person of the Trinity is incarnational, meaning manifesting himself, he is speaking of Christ there. Let me show you one other place. Turn to 32, 34 of Exodus. Exodus 32, 34. He says in 32, 34, "But go now," of verse 34, "lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel, my messenger shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin." Just another reference to that angel who would go before and lead them. The Lord Jesus is the one who is doing the leading. That is how Paul can say that rock was Christ back in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 4. Turn back to that, and let's go to chapter 10, verse 5. In 10:5, after he gets through saying all of that, they were baptized into Moses through the cloud and the sea. They identified with Moses. He is the mediator of that covenant. He is the one whom they identified with, were baptized into Moses. There, they together partook of the manna from heaven and the drink that was provided by the rock through Christ. He says they had all of that. They had all of that baptism, communion-like events, just like you do. And yet, notice verse 5 of chapter 10, "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased." You see what I'm trying to develop here for you? I'm trying to show you that the Corinthians are depending on their identification with Christ through baptism, the physical act of baptism, and the partaking of the communion elements as protection from sin. Protection from the influences of sin. That didn't work for the Jews. That's what Paul's saying. It didn't work for these people, and they had God's presence with them. That's the example. It's a negative example of you're going to be in danger of being disqualified in this race because you're depending on ritual instead of self-control. For some people, that's all their Christian life is just a bunch of ritual, never addressing issues of self-control and self-restraint and letting the Spirit of God work to help you deny yourself so that you might run the race. See, none of that stuff protected them. That is what Paul is saying in verse 5. God was not pleased with them. And that's what you guys are facing, he's saying. In spite of all the miraculous events that took place, the miracle of manna, the miracle of the Red Sea, and all the other miracles they saw, didn't protect them. That's why Paul refers to these people, their fathers. Let me read some psalms to you. Psalm 78:8. You don't have to turn there. Just write this one down. Psalm 78, verse 8. "And not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart." It did some of those outward things, but it did not prepare its heart, "and whose spirit was not faithful to God." Listen to Psalm 95, verse 10. "For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who err in their heart, and they do not know my ways." Listen to Psalm 90, verses 7 through 9. This is the emotional trauma of watching God strike down that generation. He says in verse 7, "For we have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in fury. We have finished our years like a sigh." It's Psalm 97 through 9. Like a sigh. Hebrews 3:13 says, "So none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin." So that's what Paul's afraid of. He's afraid the Corinthians are going to be disqualified because they weren't protected by their baptism and communion-like experiences, and neither are you guys. Neither are you guys. They don't help you run the race. There's nothing wrong with baptism and communion. They're good things. We should all participate in baptism and communion as Christians. But to think that those things are going to protect me and help me in running the race against my flesh and sin is not true. Not true. Ritual is no substitute. So they were being hindered by that. And like I said, not much has changed in 2,000 years. People today are still depending on ritual. But that's no substitute for godly self-control. Notice the second thing. Notice what he does in verses 6 and following. This is the second hindrance. First hindrance was your ritualism, thinking that's going to do something for you. That's a weight you're trying to carry, and it's holding you back in the race. The second thing is, notice he says, it was their view of evil and sinful desires. Notice in verse 6, now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Craved evil desires, craved evil things. 1,500 years have elapsed since this, and still nothing has changed. To the Corinthians, 1,500 years had passed, and nothing had changed. They too were craving evil desires. And what he's going to do here is list four examples of how they are craving evil desires. And all of these relate specifically to temple and pagan worship and food sacrificed to idols, and all of those things. He's going to list four things. These are their cravings. These are the wantings of their heart, the desires of their heart. And they're tolerating these things in their mind and in their heart. This generation did not prepare their heart. In other words, they had controlling desires in their heart that flirted with and engaged in these sins that are listed here in these verses. They were not taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. That's what Paul says we have to do. The battleground is in the cravings in our heart. That's where your battle is this morning, and my battle is. It's the cravings of my heart. It's those evil desires in my heart. The actions are just the result of what's going on in my heart. What I think about all the time and what I dwell on all the time, what I crave in my heart and desire in my heart. And Paul says we need to learn from their example and not crave the evil desires that they craved. That's what he is telling the Corinthians. I read a really good little book here called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. The Expulsive Power of a New Affection by Thomas Chalmers, written in the mid-1800s. And basically, he talks about replacing the controlling desires of your heart with a greater affection. The controlling affection of your heart with a greater affection. John Piper, commenting on this book, he says, I wanted to get the air out of a beaker. You know what a beaker is? One of those things you broke in chemistry class? A beaker? Container. If you wanted to get the air out of the beaker, how do you get it out? You fill it with water, and it forces the air out. And that's what he's saying here. He is saying we need to replace controlling desires in the heart, expulsing them, getting rid of those desires, not by so much trying to pump them out of our heart, but rather replacing them with another controlling desire. It's a great little read. I mean, he really hits the nail on the head. My problem is my affections. My problems are what I desire. I need to change what I desire. And his point is, you can't just walk around with an empty heart. It's got to be replaced with something else. And he's saying the affections of the heart. This book is specifically about the affections for the world. Worldliness. He says to replace those worldly affections, I need an affection for God. I need a weightier affection to force out the other affections. I've minimized so much of what he says. It's a deep read, but it's a great read. It's just so true. James 1:14 says, each one is tempted, get this, this is the birthing process. Each one is tempted when he is carried away, enticed by his own lust. When lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. It's our own sin. It's in our own heart. When lust is in the heart, it gives birth to sin. When it's the controlling desire of the heart, it gives birth to sin. So your imagination is your problem. Your imagination is where you have to do battle. Your imagination is where your cravings are. Things that linger in your mind, and they keep you from making progress in the Christian race. And so we need to replace those affections with Godward affections and force them out. Well, here's what he does. He says, because they craved evil things, these were some of their sins. And I'll just run through this list. Notice in verse 7 through 10 of 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 7 through 10, these were sins that they committed during the Exodus. And these are sins that the Corinthians are in danger of committing as well. He says, four things. Do not be idolatrous. Do not act immorally. Do not let us try the Lord, and do not grumble. Look in verse 7. Don't be idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Idolaters, I think, probably a reference, most likely a reference to, because of the quotation there, to Exodus 32. The golden calf, remember the golden calf? They melted all the gold and made this calf, and they worshipped it. They sat down and gorged themselves on food and drink and got drunk, and their self-restraint was let down, and they committed all kinds of, the euphemism there for play is cultic dancing and sexual immorality. It's associated with idol worship. That's what they did. Because they craved evil, this is one of the sins they committed. When you crave evil, it's manifested in different sins. And this is one of the sins that they did. They thought they were so protected. They thought they could just be around these things and not be taken up in them, but they were swallowed up in it. Remember, back in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I believe it was, the Corinthians thought that sexual morality was just a bodily function, no big deal. Food is for the stomach is for food, was their saying. They just minimized the danger of it. But in this passage here, it led to the death of 3,000 people in one day. They stood up to play. They sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. And, 3,000 people died in that day. Look at verse 8. Nor let us act immorally. Kind of goes along with the one before it, but he's talking about when 23,000 people fell in one day. This is when they were worshiping the Moabite god, Baal Peor. Ritual prostitution and tens of thousands of people died that day. Verse 9, nor let us try the Lord as some of them did and were destroyed by the serpents. This is discontentment. This is when they were responding to God's provision. There was no water. They wanted water. Then they don't like this food. We can't stand this food. This manna is awful. We don't want it anymore. Their greed, their self-focus, their discontentment. And God said they went astray in their hearts. They wanted fewer righteous restrictions on their lives. And God brings a poisonous, note it says in verse 9, he destroyed them with serpents. He turns loose a plague of snakes. Can you think of anything worse? Plague of snakes. And bit them. And more people died that day as well. See, those are things that go on in that temple. Immorality, idolatry, you're discontent with God. You got to find something more than God. You don't like the restrictions that God would place on your liberties. These are sins that would be right down the Corinthian alley. And then notice verse 10, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. You could find tons of verses in Exodus and Numbers about this. They grumbled all the time. I've been to the Sinai Desert. I understand why they grumble. That is a horrible place, desolate place. But they grumbled, and God was with them, and God was providing for them, and God was protecting them. But this, I believe, is referring to the time when they grumbled about Moses and Aaron as their leaders. Moses and Aaron, they did not want them to lead them anymore. This was Korah's rebellion. This was the rebellion when they were trying to just bring somebody else in to lead them. And God would have no part of it, and he swallowed them up. And the next day, verse 41 of Numbers 16 says, the people got up and grumbled again. And they were mad at Moses and Aaron for causing Korah and that group to get killed the day before. Grumbling about that, it's your fault they got killed and God took them. Tells you what God thinks about grumbling. It's an attack at God when you grumble, because basically you don't accept his sovereignty. You don't accept his design. You could do it better and you want it your way. That's what they were doing. 14,000 people died that day. There were a lot of funerals. There were a lot of funerals in Israel in the wilderness. A lot of funerals. But this fits really well with 1 and 2 Corinthians, because the Corinthians are starting to grumble against Paul's apostolic authority as well. What's he saying to them? He is saying, you want to run this race, don't do it the way your fathers in Israel did it in the wilderness. Don't follow their example. You are in danger of going down the very same path they went down. Trusting in ritual, trusting in your craving of evil things like they craved evil things. You want to go back there into that lifestyle of the temple because it feeds your evil desires, manifested in immorality and idolatry, and testing God and grumbling because you're not satisfied with something. This is a message to us, no doubt, because that's exactly what verse 11 says. These things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. God's ways do not change, is what Paul is saying in that verse. His character doesn't change. He doesn't change. His reward and judgments are the same. The same way he treated that generation, he'll treat this generation and our generation. The same thing. Some people in Corinth are going to get sick at the communion table because of the way they're doing communion. We're going to see that in chapter 11. Some people have already died because of their immorality around the communion table. God's judgment is the same. And so, that's how Paul ends this in chapter 10, verse 11, this section anyway. You can either follow the path of Israel or you can, and not turn back. They didn't turn back. Or you can follow the way that leads to Christ and cling to Christ. That's the point. Cling to Christ. Look to Christ. Fix your eyes on him as you run this race. Run it well. One option leads to displeasure and death. The other leads to reward, winning the race. I heard an illustration by Steve Lawson as he was talking about this passage. He's talking about a logging company, a man who had a logging company, and he was operating this logging company up in the mountains. And the only way to get up and down was by a very narrow road, down the mountain and up the mountain. And he was interviewing some individuals to drive the truck that would take the logs down the mountain. And so he had this first guy come in, and he asked this man, well, how good of a driver you are? These are the conditions. How good of a driver are you? And the man said, well, I'm qualified, I'm experienced. I can drive as close as 3 inches to the edge of the road, to the drop-off. 3 inches. I'm a good driver. I can get that close and go down that mountain. The second man came in and he said, oh, I'm a very good driver. I can actually have one wheel over the edge a little bit. And then finally, the third man came in, and he says, "How good a driver are you?" And he says, "I don't know if I'm good or not, but I try to get as far away from the edge as possible." And he said, "That's the guy I want right there. My cargo is too valuable. The cargo is too valuable to entrust it to people that want to live on the edge and hope they don't go over the edge." And that's where, unfortunately, too many Christians want to live, is on the edge. How far can I go? Rather than how far from the edge can I stay? That's what the Corinthians were seeking to do. How far can we go and still be okay? Listen, if you're here this morning and you don't know Christ, you need to start with that. Running the race is something we do as Christians, but getting in the race is something that God must do in your heart to put you in this race. Must save you and redeem you. He must make you right with himself through faith in Christ. You can't make yourself right. You can't make yourself good enough to approach God. He did that for you in Christ. He lived a perfect life, and he died a perfect death for you. Two things he did in your place. And Jesus says, "I'm the only way to God. There's no other way to God but through Christ." That's how you get in this race, and then you run it with everything you've got from the power that he gives you to run it. That's sanctification. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for your word and your truth today. God, may we learn from this example. May we realize, God, that all of our ritual, all of the things we do in the Christian life, they're not going to protect us from a lack of self-control or a lack of self-restraint. They're not going to protect us from living a life that's pleasing to God or running a race unencumbered or without getting entangled in sin. We just pray, Father, that you would work in us and conform us to the image of your Son. Put a desire in everyone here to run this race, not to be serious about it, but to be serious about it. We live in dangerous times. We live in times where people are searching and looking for answers. We live in times when there's a lot of hopelessness in the world around us, and we have the hope of the gospel. May we be vessels that can carry a message that has a life to back up that message. We praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.